this really, but hello, I'm Kathy Wagner. I am a member of the Environmental Humanities Research Cluster, also in the English department. I'm a writer. And I'm here to introduce this symposium. Welcome to the Approaching Extinction, Contesting Extinction Symposium, which has been put together by myself, Iñaki Pradanos, Suzanne McCullough, Ilaria Tabusa-Marcian, and Ryan Gunderson, all faculty here at Miami University, except for Suzanne, who is now at Athabasca University, but still with us, in body and spirit, I believe, yes. So right now, we're going to get started with a welcome from Kara Strass and George Ironstrack of the Miamia Center. Please welcome George and Kara.
Aya aya, te pewe nyo akako kia waha nungi kaki hikwe, waha miamionge shepia hikwe nungi kaki hikwe. Nila miamia metro senya, ame me shikia wenzo ane, me he Saka Chakwa, Penjoa, Takamwa, Nehepalanaswa, Ila Pikasiani. Mikimwanya Waha Miamia Nipwayone Kaninge. Greetings, it's good to see all of you here today. Welcome to Miamionge, to Oxford, which is a part of the Miami homelands, as well as the homelands of our elder brothers, the Shawangwa and the Shawnee. My name is George Ironstrack, and I'm a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, and I work here at the Miamia Center at Miami University. My Miamia families come from the Fort Wayne area, Kikayonge, and today my Miamia family can be found also in Chicago, as well as extended kin in Kansas and Oklahoma today. I come from the families of Takamwa and Sacajawea, today known as the Godfrey original families.
Aye Chenge, Peweniala Kakoke, Awaha Nukikakikwe, Makunzakwa Wains Waane, Nila Nyanikwia, Tupia, Takamwa, Nehe Penjiwa, Lapkasione, We Pechakionge, Emenotiane, Mikimwaane Nyame, Nepoyana Kanige. Hi everyone, my name is Kara Strass. I am also a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma and work here at the Miamia Center at Miami University. I come from the families of Tupia and also Chief Richardville and Chief LaFontaine families, and come from the Huntington, Indiana Fort area, which is where my Miami family mostly lives still today.
So just give us a little bit of an overhead view of where we are in terms of our homelands. This is a map that we call Miamionge. We recognize that's not, our ancestors didn't refer to this space in those terms, but it's useful for us to be able to describe our homelands in a broader sense. This is the space that Miamion people lived their lives prior to contact with Europeans. As you can see, it was a shared landscape. Lots of other tribes lived on these lands too. We all had our own heartlands, strategic centers where our permanent villages were located. Ours sat on the northern reaches of the Wabash River, from where West Lafayette, Indiana is today, up to what is today Fort Wayne, Indiana. And then to situate Oxford here, Miamion Nishnipwanekami, the big Miami schools, what we call Miami University in our language, we're located here in the Great Miami River Valley. So the River Valley then had lots of things named after it, including Miami University. So today we share our tribal name with Miami University through that River Valley. As I said, our people lived in that home, that our homelands, we say, from time immemorial until a massive series of disruptions occurred in the earliest years of the founding of the United States. And the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma has a governmental record that extends back in terms of its relationships with the U.S. to our first treaty of the United States government in 1795. We signed the Treaty of Greenville, which is Greenville, Ohio, just to the north of here, to establish peace with our new neighbors, the United States. And in return for peace, we had to cede control of the land where Oxford sits today, as well as other small parcels scattered throughout our homelands.
So today, Miami University has a relationship with the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma that spans almost 50 years. And that relationship is based in primarily three things: a shared name, a shared place, and a shared goal for education. So George talked to you about that shared name, Miami, coming from the Miami River Valley. And I think that it was very important, actually, that that shared name is what kind of kicked off this relationship. The shared place that Oxford sits in our traditional homelands, as well as a shared goal for education. So the chiefs who came here and started this relationship were very interested in sharing our culture with Miami University, but also having Miami students come here and be able to gain an education. So this relationship started in 1972 when the chief at that time, Chief Forrest Olds, came to Miami University unexpectedly. I actually really like to imagine this interaction when he shows up at the president's office and says, "Hi, my name is Chief Forrest Olds. I'm the chief of the Miami tribe." And they really had no idea, I think, what to do with him. But it actually kicked off this relationship that continued to grow over time. And for a while, it was really personal relationships between the chief of the Miami tribe and usually presidents, vice presidents, alumni, professors at Miami University. And that's how it grew for quite a while until it was Chief Floyd Leonard who really institutionalized many of the partnerships that we have still today, including our Miami students, who first came here in 1991. So there were three students who arrived in 1991. And it started really just as a scholarship. There was not really much for them. But our Miami Heritage Program has grown tremendously over time. Our students now come in as part of a program where they learn about their language and culture and come to explore who they are as Miami people during their 4 years here at Miami University. So we currently have 32 Miami students who are here this year, and we have 85 graduates of Miami University who are Miami tribal citizens. And so we really feel that we are building the next generation of Miami thinkers, of Miami intellectuals. Another outcome of this relationship is the Miami Center. So the Miami Center is really the research arm of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, focused primarily on language and cultural revitalization. And so it started with this idea of language revitalization when the center was founded in 2001, that was trying to think through how you could do language revitalization from documentation. So the last speakers of the Miami language passed in the mid-1900s, and so Darrell Baldwin and David Costa, who are both here in the audience today, we're looking at this idea of language revitalization. And over time, it's really grown to include cultural revitalization at the same time. What are you learning from this linguistic data that's in the archives? And then today, we use this language and culture to teach our Miami students on campus.
We are still alive, and to be a little more superliteral, we are living as human beings. We are still alive as human beings. You compare that with a word that David and Darrell struggled to come up with to describe extinction in our own language. In 2018, I say, working together with Bernard Perley and Meg Newton, wrestling with this what they call invasive concept of extinction. So this term, they have all died, was the term at the time they could come up with to roughly approximate extinction. To understand they have all died to be extinct, you have to have other context from the language. So it is possible to say, Mimiake, Chekine, Cheke, all the passenger pigeons have died. Or Mishiwiake, Chekine, Cheke, all the Eastern elk have died. Those are species that are gone. Us as a people, as Kara described, have survived this concept being deployed against us, so that our language for most of my childhood was described as extinct. And we as a people have been dealing with the forces that some folks call extinction for hundreds of years, from literal attempts to kill us with our wars in the United States that lasted through 1813, 1814, to more social forms of death where as we'll talk about in a moment, boarding schools and other cultural means were used to cause our existence to cease as a distinct and different people, so a different kind of extinction. And yet, we are still living as human beings. So today we're going to welcome you to our lands through three stories. We're not going to tell these stories in their entirety, but rather do a little bit of analysis of them as a way to introduce you. And the first story that we're going to reference is a story that is an Alusukane, what we call a winter story. These stories are seasonal, they're only told in the wintertime, and they involve complicated beings with which we share our world. And there are means by which many of us today wrestle with things that we feel can't be known with certainty. Another kind of story that we'll also share with you today is called Achimune, a historical narrative. And those can be recounted at any time of year. This is a quote from a character in one of our, a being in one of our Alusukane named Wisaka Chakwa. And Wisaka Chakwa we call Nimeshuma, our grandfather. And he was here before humans. He helped shape the world the way it is today. And yet at the same time, despite having all these powers, he almost seems to always find himself in a place where he almost dies due to his own foolishness. So this quote, Ngokate, metosenui kwewaha, you all can't live here anymore, comes from a story in which Wisaka Chakwa abuses other people and greedily seeks knowledge for his own ends. And then in doing so, he finds himself torn out of his place and sent someplace else far away. That's one of the consequences that he suffers. These stories have multiple interpretations, but we always want to respect the individual right to interpret, but I thought we'd start by asking Carol, when you hear this story, which is told a lot, what are some things that come to mind for you?
So as George mentioned, we don't typically interpret these stories as one meaning, but I think it's fair to say that for multiple times in this story that Wisaka Chakwa, he does something that is inappropriate. He abuses people or animals in a way that both he knows is wrong and others around him know is wrong. He acts very greedily, both with knowledge and with physical resources, and that there are consequences for him. I think it's fair to say that that's kind of the highest level understanding of the story, so I'm not afraid to kind of give that as one of the outcomes of the story. But at the same time, I think it reminds us that for Myanmar people, our cultural understanding is that for us as human beings, that our actions have consequences. And that as a community, we're trying to look and turn inwards towards what are our communal actions and what are our individual actions and how do those have impacts on the world and the people around us. So before George will give you a little bit of an extended piece of history, I do want to kind of to talk about the Ndamya people and who we are today. So we are about 5,500 tribal citizens, and we live across the entire United States. We are a community that's in diaspora. However, we do come together in a variety of ways, one of which is through coming together physically as people. This is a picture from this year's national gathering, the 2019 national gathering that we had this past summer. But also using technology and other ways of coming together as a community to stay together culturally. We do have a tribal government that's made up of 5 elected officials that we vote in every summer during that tribal, the national gathering. I think I talk to classes all the time about tribal sovereignty, and I think it's something that's very hard for most Americans at least to understand because it's not something that we talk about. We have a tribal government who's making decisions for our government just in the way that the United States government is making decisions, and they impact us at a variety of levels, from the governmental level down to the personal level. And then we practice language and culture together. So this is a picture of stomp dancing. This picture was just taken in January. Stomp dance is a type of dance that's being revitalized within our community, similarly to the way that language is being revitalized. So in addition to coming together as a community, we're coming together to practice language and culture. So this dance was not practiced for a long time, and we're coming back to it. We're just now able to lead our own stomp dances as a community again. And language is an important part of this. We use language to draw people into the dance, language actually in the songs that are spoken in the dance. And so those things are intertwined in a way that's very hard to pull apart. But we are a product of our history, and we always think that it's important to give that context. And so George will give you a little bit more historical context.
So today, our population of 5,500 is spread across the United States, we believe currently in all 50 states as well as internationally. We have three main population centers. The first is our sovereign, the capital of our nation, where our sovereign land base sits in northeast Oklahoma here. Sarah in the town of Miami, Oklahoma. The second largest population center is in north central Indiana, from Huntington to Fort Wayne, Indiana, in the Wabash River Valley, the heart of our traditional homelands. And the third largest population center is in eastern Kansas, which, as you'll see, the second was our first destination following our 1846 forced removal. So as I said, we signed our first treaty with the United States in 1795 that ceded the land where Oxford sits today, which was primarily for our people hunting grounds, as well as a major trade thoroughfare to cross the Ohio River near Cincinnati and other points. And in the 50 years that followed, we signed 12 more treaties with the United States, ceding the rest of our traditional, or almost all of our traditional homelands. And you can imagine that's a pretty rapid pace of change for us. So this entire land base is what sustained us economically in the most basic sense of that word. And in 50 years, our economy had to transform itself in very negative ways, high levels of oppression and various kinds of violence. And then in 1846, our nation was broken in half and were forcibly removed. So in 1846, there were actually army troops called in from Cincinnati to enforce the terms of an earlier treaty. And the tribal nation, as well as 323 citizens of that nation, were removed west via the canals and the river systems to Kansas Landing on the edge of the Oregonized territory, and then they walked to our new reservation in Kansas. About 150 people were allowed to remain behind in Indiana, but there were scattered individual families living up and down the Wabash, as you'll find us today. After the Civil War, the exact same process repeated itself, and the tribal nation was forced to remove to the northeast corner of Indian Territory, which is today Oklahoma. And once again, about 30 individuals stayed behind on their brand new homes, their brand new farms in Kansas. And they were forced to leave the nation and assume citizenship under the mantle of the United States. Throughout that process, loss of control over where we live, how our populations are concentrated, we also lost control of the education of our youth, which probably had the most dramatic impact on our ability to maintain our sense of ourselves through the boarding school systems. Places like Carlisle Industrial School, Haskell, this is Shawnee Mission School here in the lower corner, all different kinds of educational entities that took in our children and taught them a particular way to think about the world, adopt the positive work ethic, go where the work is, leave your extended kin behind, not to share resources in a collective way anymore, and also not to teach your language to your children. So as best as we can tell, Myaumya people who left these schools still spoke Myaumya. They still spoke Myaumya Kamingi. They joked with people their own age, but they no longer passed the language on to those younger than them. And this sent our language into a steep decline, which began in the early 20th century. And as Kara said, the last speakers of our language began passing away in the mid-20th century. So today we're going to share two stories with you here quickly at the end that highlight how the return of language, awakening our language from dormancy, awakened all these other things. We're not going to be able to talk about all of them today. We're going to focus on storytelling and the way we tell stories about ourselves and about the world around us and the impact we think that's had on us as a people.
So the first story that I'm going to tell you, a historical narrative, is about the process of allotment in Oklahoma. And the mining that happened kind of concurrently with that allotment process. So George told you the history of Myaumya people being removed from our homelands, eventually ending up in Oklahoma.
But the next part of that story is when the communal reservation lands, where we lived together as a tribal nation, were split up and allotted to individual families. So individual Myanmar people were given 200 acres per person. And the idea for the United States government was that Myanmar people would then live on their own land, not come together communally as a tribal nation any longer. Again, another way of trying to make us no longer be a distinct a people, right? That we would assimilate into the larger United States culture, and they wouldn't have to worry about this Indian problem that they continue to have even after the removal era. So this is a map of Northeast Oklahoma. It's a little bit harder to see, and I'll come back to it in a minute and kind of zoom in on it, but you can see that in Northeast Oklahoma that there are many different tribal nations in that area. That is true today as well. And that this process of allotment really happened to all of these tribal nations. This wasn't just something that's a story for Myanmar people. But if we zoom in on a map that was actually created by the Miami tribe as part of a publication that came out, we're able to kind of zoom in on these allotments. And so you can see each number, it correlates to an individual allotment, and the colors represent the family group that that person came from. And so you can see that these families still grouped together, tried to stay together on these allotment lands, but that were spread out over this vast area in Northeast Oklahoma, and start to live on individual pieces of land. The communal land was supposed to go to future generations. Much of it was lost. And so this 200 acres was put into a protective state for about 25 years. At the end of that 25 years, many Myanmar people sold their land because of the debts that they had accrued. Some of it was taken because of those debts. They could pass it on to family members, but then it would be split up into smaller and smaller parcels. And so this land that was given to Myanmar people as part of the allotment process, it just was not enough to sustain us. We could not live on this land that we now were given as part of the allotment process. And so many Myanmar people kind of fell into poverty. So coming back to this map, I want to zoom in just on the very northeast corner of Oklahoma, because one of the other things that's marked on this map, and it may be a little bit hard to see, but there are some dots on this map, mostly throughout, and you can't see, this is actually Quapaw land, and each of those different dots is a mine. So in northeast Oklahoma, there is lead and zinc in the ground, and so these individual mines were leases from the United States government to open a mine to extract this lead and zinc. But it was very hard to get the lead and zinc out of the ground. What you actually have to do is extract it, crush it up to pull all of those minerals out of the ground. And then what you're left with is a whole lot of what we today call chat or tailings. That were put back on top of the ground. And so Oklahoma, for any of you who have been there, is very flat. But as you kind of drive around, you can see what look like essentially mountains. So there are these huge chat piles kind of scattered across the landscape there. And what this has meant for people in Northeast Oklahoma is that there's a lot of environmental degradation due to the outcomes of these mines, that as they left, these chat piles are left, they have wind dispersion all across Northeast Oklahoma, as well as the mines that filled with water, and the water becomes contaminated, contaminates much of the water in this area. And so it's this this leftover, environmental degradation that is by no means something that these tribal nations could have predicted when they moved onto this land, right? In addition to the resource extraction physically from the land, I told you the story of Myanmar people falling into poverty. We weren't able to sustain ourselves on the land, so many Myanmar people also went and worked in these mines that had horrible working conditions. And so this process kind of you know, continued this process of assimilation, but also personal degradation of these people who lived in the, or worked in the mines. So this is a picture from an Institute for Environmental Science here at Miami University who went to Oklahoma in 2011 to look at the environmental impacts of the mines. This is a second picture of them walking onto one of these chat piles. So it gives you not only kind of how large are these, that you can see these people look very small by walking on them, but you can also see that the chat pile has begun to kind of calcify, become hardened. And so when actually a tornado went through, it blew much of that chat away, and you could see these calcified pieces that were left behind. And so even removing this would be a process that would be, you know, you have to kind of physically blow it up or do something to actually remove these calcified pieces. So where does that leave us today as a tribal nation? Much of our land was lost through this allotment process. Actually, all of our land was lost in Oklahoma, and communally held land was lost. But today we're trying to rebuild that land, and we're able to purchase land back as a tribal nation. Some of that land can be put into trust so that we can exercise our sovereign rights on that land. And this is something that has helped us to rebuild as a community. And that is an amazing story that's helping us to thrive once again as a tribal nation. But that process is also fraught, right? So there's all of this environmental degradation that we have to be aware of as we rebuild this tribal land base that we have to consider when we have one of our summer youth programs. Is it in the wind zone for these chat piles that are gonna blow this lead tailings into where we hold these camps? We have agriculture and cattle that we raise as a tribal nation. What land can we buy that doesn't have as bad of an environmental degradation so that we can raise this tribal cattle that we then eat together as a community? So I just want to leave you with this idea that we are trying to rebuild, and land is a big part of that. And that's a process that's very positive, but also one that's very fraught.
So as I already stated, we use our stories as a community to wrestle with who we are, who we were, and what's our place in the universe, really, as a people. And that occurs both through historical narratives, like Kara just recounted, as well as all the Sukane winter stories. So I'm going to talk briefly about a winter story. And this one's a little closer to where we are. This story occurs a little closer to where we are today. So it occurs inside this black box here, about a 2.5-hour drive from Oxford in the valley of the Namatjesinwisipiwe, the Mississinewa River. So to zoom in on our homelands map here, you can see the Namatjesinwisipiwe. And the story we're going to talk about occurs roughly about here. It occurs in a place that is known by two names, Lenapinja Okane, the waters of Lenapinja, as well as Ashebekwa Wayne Range Kwapiche, the double cliffs. Here's a beautiful photo of the double cliffs. You can see a couple people in a canoe. So you can see about how large they are. And there's a large natural spring that sits back here. And the runoff from that spring that has carved these beautiful limestone cliffs in half. There's a picture from another angle of Lenapinja Okane. So Lenapinja Okane is out here in the water. And I'll shift back while we range Kwapiche, another angle of it here. The story that we're going to refer to comes from this man, Wa Benganke Kapo, so this is Gabriel Godfrey. And I descend from his older brother, Wa Kikapo. And Wa Benganke Kapo used to tell this story, and he learned it from the family of these people, Te Kwakia on the left, and his wife, Kekenakishwa, here on the right. And the story is about human behavior in that space of Lenapinja Okane. It's a story about fire hunting at night, hunting for fish and for white-tailed deer. And Te Kwakia, the story is in his voice. He talks about asking the being who lives there, Lenapinja, for help in his hunting pursuits. And he's very specific about what he asks for. And at the very end, he finishes his process of asking, and his wife says, "You should have asked for a white perch," but he didn't ask. And then they go on and they hunt, and he ends up taking more than he asked for. And after doing that, then a white perch presents itself to them. And when he tries to take the white perch, the being who lives there, Lenapingia, drags them and starts to pull them to the deep part of the river. And there's this moment of fear that paralyzes them, and then suddenly they're let go. And at the end of the story, Kinepikishwa laughs at Tekwakya and says, "Ask for it, ask for it." So we recount this story today in English, although we're lucky we also have it in Miao Miao Tewenge in our language, because while Benanke Kapwa, he sat down with a man named Jacob Dunn and recorded this story and helped as well translate it in English. It's a very, very powerful story that he had, and he gives a little bit of extra information in that story about Lenapingia, about the being who lives in that space. So we tell that story today, but we also then talk about how we can't connect to the double cliffs like Wapanake Kapwa could, like Tekwakya could. And that's because the double cliffs now sit under water here in the Mississinewa Reservoir. In the early years of settlement, actually beginning in the 1840s, I've seen accounts already in the 1840s, that the changes wrought by settlers in northern Indiana caused intense flooding. So the Wapashikisipi, where the Wabash River was full of beautiful islands, and already by the 1840s, those islands were being washed away by floods. As settlers filled in wetlands and drained them to build farm fields, to farm the way they wanted to, all that water concentrated in these rivers. And massive floods, like a 1913 flood in Wabash, overtook towns in the river. This is a legacy of a long period, decades of misbehavior from our perspective on the part of settlers leads to massive floods. There's other factors at play in the 1913 flood. It was really cold, the ground was frozen, so there's lots of factors, but that the water came in the way it came in unprecedented levels was a result of settlement. And there were progressive floods then throughout the early 20th century, not as bad as the 1913 flood, but progressive floods. I listened to stories from elders in our community about being called out of school, leaving school to go pack sandbags in Peru, Indiana. And this resulted in an act passed by the United States government in 1958 to create water management tools throughout the Midwest. And one of those tools they created was the Mississinewa Dam, the Earthen Dam. That's construction completed in 1967, and then flooded that part of the Mississinewa River Valley where Shipekwamish Range Quapitcha sits. So you can see here, I'm gonna zoom in, this is the terrain where the double cliffs were, they're still there underneath the water. You can basically see the site driving over here on that road in Indiana. And so this site is distant from us in a way now. I've taken my own children, I've taken young students here, and we've sat on that bridge and looked over the site, talked about the story. There's reasons why culturally you can't tell the story in this spot, but you can talk about the story there. And it's powerful to sit there over the waters and to think about our ancestors living in this space, but it's not as powerful as being able to actually see the double cliffs. It's very, very different. And so we connect to the story, it has power and meaning to us, but some of that power is we're distant from it because of changes wrought by the processes, by decisions that human beings made, right? These didn't happen passively. People made decisions dating all the way back to the earliest years of settlement that led to this problem from an American perspective of being too much water and the water needing to be controlled. For once in my life, one small, brief moment, I got to see the double cliffs because earthen dams are terrible. If you haven't researched them, they don't work really well for long periods of time. They sink, and they have to be repaired, and they had to drain the lake. So when they drained the lake, a friend of mine's father, who knew that it was a moment they had to grab, took me there. And I didn't really know what I was seeing at the time, but I'm eternally grateful that they took me down into the valley and walked. And it was very weird to be down in what is a river valley, but was a lake, and you can imagine the destruction of what you witness when the lake recedes. And the memory of having to move our cemeteries, the whole towns having to relocate, all these massive changes wrought by environmental changes caused by behaviors of settlement was really striking when I was down there. I remember that. But then the lake came back up. And so right now you can't see, at least you can't see most of the Double Cliffs. Some winters, a little bit of them becomes exposed. But we tell this story regularly. The story of Anapinjalkami, of Tequakia, and Kihikanekishu, fire hunting in this place, and reminding people of how we should behave as human beings, and our connections to places in our homelands where our ancestors lived for generations, even if we can't go and touch the limestone of the Double Cliffs anymore. Our children are hearing these stories and drawing their own lessons from them. So coming back full circle to the story of Wisaka Chakwa, right, and his foolish greed, and as he shouts, he's actually shouting this at birds. You all can't live here, is how it gets translated, but he's shouting at the birds, you all can't live here like human beings, which is supposed to be funny and nonsensical. We're meant to laugh. But there's also other meanings at play in Wisaka Chakwa's attempt to figure out how he could live as a human being, what's the proper way to behave, and what's the consequences when you misbehave. I think that the contrast is clear, right, between Tequakia's perception of misbehaving and being an immediate drastic consequence, and the misbehavior of businesses subleasing land from the United States government to mine and then leave waste behind, and there being no direct individual consequence for that behavior.
So in conclusion, as we put together this presentation, we kept coming back to the idea of a Miamia way of thinking about these things, right? That for Miamia people, we can look inwardly, right, for what is the correct way to behave? What are the consequences if you don't behave in that way? And that is something that we've done now as a community, trying to come back together. Revitalization is part of that process of looking to a Miamia way of understanding in order to thrive as a tribal community once again. One of the challenges for us, though, is that we now live within this larger system, right, of the United States, of the world, and that we don't always have control over some of these larger issues, like removal, like allotment, like mining, like damming, all of these things. But for us, I think it's still important to understand what is it that allows us to come back together and have an understanding of what the proper way is to live as human beings, right? And so what I would challenge us to think about as a group is, what are those things that are driving the larger community, right? We're making these larger decisions that have impacts on all of us, but also what are the smaller, more local decisions that we can make that teach us how to behave as individuals within a community to move forward. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
You mentioned that you cannot tell the story in the place. Mm-hmm. Culturally, you cannot. Why is that?
So the being Lenapingia that the story centers on, you're not supposed to name Lenapingia where Lenapingia lives, because you'll be summoning Lenapingia. And the rough shorthand is, if you're canoeing and you name Lenapingia, you're going for a swim that day. It's kind of how I'm describing. So even though I'm in a car over the bridge, I still respect that tradition and don't recount the story in that place.
Thanks a lot for your contribution. I think it's very important for all of us to place this history as a context for what we're doing with the symposium. So in the lands of the Lenape and the Haudenosaunee in the northeast where I currently live, there are stories of prophecies of return to rematriate the land, put it back in the hands of the original caretakers. Mm-hmm. And several projects have occurred as a result of that, among them Tom Porter's Kanetsio Kareke project to create a food sovereignty land base just west of Albany. And then other initiatives like Northeast Farmers of Color lobbying for community land tiling as reparations in return for indigenous lands. It's within the context of decolonization. And in this context, there's pressure towards institutions to hand back the lands to the original people. And their allies were mobilizing for that. And there's a lot of resistance, including from universities.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a similar or comparable situation here? Are there similar efforts, similar initiatives? If so, can you speak a little bit about them?
So among the Nyanyake, among our people, there's nothing that compares in terms of actively seeking the return of land, in terms of asserting ourselves. Instead, I would say that in our community, we've been seeking to build relationships according to our standards of what is a good relationship in the places where we live today and where we used to live. And through that, individuals, so not corporate entities or governmental entities, individuals have been returning land to the tribe, giving land in various ways. We just recently had a parcel donated back to the tribe that's in very near our sort of center historically, Kikayoki in Fort Wayne. There's land in Ohio that's been donated back that we would recognize as kind of on the periphery of a traditional homeland, so still is a part of it. So I would say those are small things, but we see them as a part of the end result of building good human-to-human relationships. And I think many of those folks are really interested in seeing tribes as folks who are authentically invested in the relationships with other than humans, with the landscape, the animals, the places, and they're seeking ecological protection, and they see the tribe as best suited to that, maybe. So that's the best I can do in this moment. So.
I would say the only thing I have to add to that is that as a tribe, I would say we're fairly pragmatic in the idea of working within systems, because that's how we've been able to make improvements over time. And so, like George said, kind of making those relationships and making a relationship with my university is one of those examples. Mm-hmm. That through this relationship, we're able to access resources that we would never have as a tribal nation in Oklahoma for research and language and cultural revitalization. And so I think we're able to work together, partially because we have an understanding of what is a good relationship, right? And what do both sides need to offer? How does that relationship need to be reciprocal? And we're very specific about working in that way. And sometimes those partnerships don't work, and recognizing that is an important part of that as well.
Could you talk a little bit about what the misbehavior that led to the flooding constituted?
Mm-hmm. Where to begin? I think focusing on a really dramatic example, in northern Indiana, but mostly in northwest Ohio, there was a place called the Great Black Swamp. And when you read especially settler narratives about the Great Black Swamp, it's a thing to be endured. If it has resources, maybe you go in there to get them, but what a yucky place. From an indigenous perspective, yes, of course, the maize and mosquitoes were fun. But it was a massive ecological resource used responsibly, was a benefit to everyone in terms of the tuberous plants that could be harvested from there, as well as the hunting. It was a benefit. But when settlers arrived in northwest Ohio, mainly from my understanding, German immigrants, they wanted to farm, and the Great Black Swamp was not farmable, and so they built drainage trenches and drained the Black Swamp, right? So that all that water had to go somewhere. And still to this day, those drainage systems have to be maintained because the Great Black Swamp wants to come back. It's a geologic force. But if you drive through there today, it's really kind of eerie when you drive on the highway through what was the Great Black Swamp, because you can just see these systematic drainage ditches And it's some of the best farmland in Ohio because the soil is the end product of thousands of years of wetland. So that's one example. And what I'd like you to say is imagine that huge swamp that you look on a map, and then throughout our homelands there were tons of little swamps. And all of those little swamps were drained to create the kind of growing circumstances that facilitate corn and soybean threats, the number one thing people were after, or at least in the 20th century. And then all that water goes somewhere. It all runs off the fields into the rivers and moves downstream to these towns. I'd say the other interesting ecological consequence is that our name for the Wabash River, Wabashikisibiwe, can be understood to mean like it glitters in the sun, and that's because the foundation of the river is limestone. But there's nowhere that I know of in the Wabash River Valley today that you can see that glittering in the sun white bottom anymore because of sedimentation and from runoff. Now, I don't by any means think the whole river glittered in the sun, but parts of it did. And that's gone for now anyway. The stone is still down there, but it's covered in sediment. Is that enough context?
That's really helpful. I was also wondering about no-till farming, because it's apparently so much better for holding water. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering about the farming practices themselves.
Yeah, and that's an area outside of our expertise in terms of Indiana farmers when they began to shift practices. But certainly from the 1840s through the early 20th century, the amount of runoff was catastrophic.
You said that the Miami Environmental Institute visited a site in northeastern Oklahoma. So were they doing environmental testing then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they were primarily focused on water testing. And then they did some work with like wind catch to see how the very, very fine tailings were spread via the wind. And then they've worked with Goldman Fellows, I think it was called, to do more complicated soil testing on the lands where we're doing our youth programs to test and see like what plants are safe to eat, what can you grow there. So they've worked at kind of multiple levels, but those big institutes were mainly focused on water testing. So what we didn't get into a lot of detail is that the water in Miami area is all contaminated from the runoff, from the tailings and so.
And that's been connected with human health impacts?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's a big problem. And then are there any ideas about, is it possible to do any kind of restoration or mitigation?
There's been lots of ideas. The challenge of damage at this level, the magnitude of then cleaning it up is, I think, fair to say, beyond human comprehension. So there's a great film that you can rent online just called Tar Creek. It's a really well-made film and gets into, they have at one point a rolling dollar count of how much money the U.S. government has spent trying to clean up the Tar Creek Superfund site. And it's still not clean.
Has that ever been bought out yet? Because the EPA tried to dig lawns out, right? And of course that didn't work. And has that whole area been bought out or just parts of it to move?
Well, so you might be thinking of Pitcher, which is a whole town that collapsed, which is where the majority of the mines were, and they literally forced everyone to move and, you know, tore down everything in the town. The topsoil has been replaced in many places in northeast Oklahoma, trying to mitigate the fact that the wind has moved all of these tailings around. But something to remember is that, again, you're pushing up against all of these tribal boundaries as well, right? And the other thing that I probably didn't mention strong enough in the presentation is that, again, because these were United States, like they were the ones that were giving the mines, the, you know, basically that they were renting these mines, that there wasn't one person that was responsible for it in the end, right? And so now we have this terrible environmental degradation. Who's responsible for it? So it's been created into a Superfund site, but there's not one kind of individual company that's responsible for paying for all of this, right? Some of the chat piles have been used to make asphalt for roads and other types of things, but
It's just a scale at which we can't imagine.
Wondering about the different relationships that you might have with other tribal communities and how that might inform you what you are doing here, or since you talked about the importance of relationships, mm-hmm. could you speak a little bit to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so as I said, we're a small tribe, so 5,500 if you're not aware of sort of tribal populations. I think in California we'd be considered a big tribe, but everywhere else in Indian country we're considered a small tribe, right? So you're talking about, you know, tribes that have populations in the hundreds of thousands and have concentrations where they're not as living in diaspora. And we're very similar to our neighbors in northeast Oklahoma. So there are 9 tribes in our county. Only one of those tribes is a quote unquote big tribe. The other 8, which are all in and around the town of Miami, are all small tribes of similar size to us and varying levels of population concentration. And so to meet our needs as communities, stretching all the way back to the 20th century, the early 20th century, we had to work together as tribal communities. So I can give a few examples of that. One is for tribal health, to build an Indian healthcare facility that can actually meet our needs in Miami, Oklahoma, requires all the tribes living there to pool their resources, their administrative as well as governmental budget resources together to operate an Indian health facility that can, to the best of its abilities, certainly day to day we might not be happy with it, but it meets our needs only because we're able to work together as communities. Managing flooding from, there's a dam in Miami too, which causes flooding almost yearly now. And so working with the federal government, U.S., the Corps of Army, Army Corps of Engineers, et cetera, requires all the tribes working together. So in lots of ways to get the things we need as a community to increase the strength of our voice, we have to pool together with tribal communities. I think speaking more personally about language and culture, we work very closely with our elder brothers in the Shawnee tribe, a group that used to be known as the Loyal Band of Shawnee. You know, they have their own history, their own stories. I won't seek to share them today, but that they've helped us learn to return stomp dance to our communities, to our community, through a lot of work on their part. And then in return, we have obligation to help them with their dances, and if possible, to help them with their efforts to revitalize their language. They still have speakers, but are facing an uncertain future. And if it works, if we're able to provide them resources that they find useful, we've offered to help them in that pursuit. So that's more of a personal cultural connection than less sort of bureaucratic and budget driven.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.